Welcome to the History of California podcast. I'm your host, Jordan Maddox. Today I'm joined by novelist Shelley Blanton Stroud for a conversation that begins in our shared hometown of Bakersfield. We'll talk about the Central Valley's culture, from cotton fields and breakfast tables to Buck Owens' Crystal Palace, and how outsiders misunderstand Bakersfield in many ways. From there, we'll dive into Shelley's craft as a writer of historical fiction, how she balances fact and imagination, and why the erased history of San Francisco's VJ Day peace riots inspired her latest novel. Along the way, we'll explore themes of memory, myth, and why California's history can tell us about who we are today. Let's go meet Shelley Blanton Stroud. Shelley, to start off this conversation, I want to talk about Bakersfield a little bit, a place you and I are both from. What do you think people perceive incorrectly about Bakersfield?
Great question. Incorrectly. All right. Maybe I'll say some things that they perceive and ways in which they may be incorrect.
Okay.
That people that I'm around tend to assume a lack of education and a kind of, the word is wrong, but stupidity from people in the region. And they go to that right away. And I know that on the one hand, I know many very educated people from Bakersfield and many people who are they apply their education in devotion to concepts and philosophies that are so good. Because my dad was a superintendent of schools there, he was surrounded by these people who had educated themselves, gotten educated, and devoted that education to serving children and teenagers who live there. And so that always bothers me a little bit when people, outsiders, are able to just wipe away all the nuance of what a region is like. And then the second part of that really is, of course, I know a lot of people from my hometown who aren't formally educated beyond high school, for instance. And what I have also observed is that's no comment upon their native intelligence. Mm-hmm. In many cases, in my own family, there are people who did not get themselves formally educated. And yet part of the reason for that was that they took on responsibility for family members. Maybe a parent had died. As an example, my own maternal grandfather, Bates Jackson, left school when he was 12 years old. It wasn't because he was stupid or had no ambition. It was because his father died and he had several siblings, and he was the oldest. He was the one who needed to work to help everybody survive. And he made quite a living for himself as a farmer. I guess I would say that people make assumptions about the intelligence and the savviness and the worldliness of people from Bakersfield. And it's pretty diminishing, pretty diminishing.
I agree with that. I had similar experiences and similar perceptions of people when I left and moved to San Francisco after high school. Just questions about what it's like to live there. And I also agree with your perception around there's different forms of intelligence, right? And some of those are acquired through formal education, whereas some are acquired through, I'll give you an example. In my summers during college, I would come home and work at a kind of a diesel mechanic shop that's near the oil fields. And one of my jobs periodically was to go and find strange parts to fix old tractors or diesel engines. Okay. And so I would drive out to these strange parts shops in the middle of nowhere, it felt. And there was one that I went into where there was a man who I think he said that he was partially blind. And I gave him a screw that I was looking for. I needed a duplicate. And he just felt it with his fingers. And then he roved the aisles and found that exact part for me. And you wouldn't say he wasn't intelligent. You would say there's a different form of intelligence at work there. But as I've gotten older, I've learned to respect the different traditions that I was around that maybe didn't appreciate as a kid, I guess.
I'm the same in that I was a total bookworm. So I was always positioned to be in a snobby relation to intelligence. Like when my dad was a superintendent of schools, it was happened to be an entire school district in one building, K-12, one building. And so on the weekends, he would take my brother and me onto campus to give my mom a break. My brother would ride his bike around those hallways, play tetherball, do all this stuff. But my dad would unlock the library for me, and I could just read my way through the library, starting with A, which obviously meant Louisa May Alcott, which explains a few things.
There you
But
go.
I always had that preference for reading and also people who read. And maybe at the time, when I left for college, I might have felt like finally I'm going to find my people and the people of the book. You know what I
Yeah.
mean? And it took some maturity for me to realize they're all my people. The people who go to college and read the books are my people. And also the people who really know how to sit around a kitchen table and tell very funny stories are also my people.
Yeah, I think Gerald Haslam did a lot of great work for the Central Valley in terms of crystallizing what we're talking about, which is just a different culture that's unlike some of the other parts of California. Now, there's a lot of things that Bakersfield's known for. One of them is closing right now, the Crystal Palace.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah. How do you perceive the world of country music, and what was your experience of that as a kid?
I would say that I came to an appreciation of country music and it mainly like in roots country music
Yeah.
later when I was an adult. However, and maybe it was because I was trying not to be from Bakersfield when I was younger, but I will say that, okay, so my dad's family, my dad was one of 10 kids, and he always said that they grew up, they immigrated during the Dust Bowl and lived in Button Willow for a while, and which is where Merle Haggard is from. And they were the same age. And my dad always told me that there's a place in Bakersfield called the Blackboard. It's no longer there. It was like the best place to go hear music, like a club where there were fights in the parking lot, and that's where you'd go to get a girl, that kind of thing.
The
So
Old West.
my dad always told me that he got in a fight in the parking lot with Merle Haggard and he broke a beer bottle over my dad's head. And so near the end of his life, which was not that long ago, I said, "Dad, is that the truth? Did Merle Haggard really break a beer bottle over your head?" And my dad was dying, and he said, "Maybe it was me, or maybe it was one of my brothers, or maybe it was somebody else." So I think I did, in adulthood anyway, absorb that feeling like that Bakersfield sound belongs to us. It has meant something to people beyond us, and have a little pride of ownership there. And I do feel that way about a lot of the music that comes out of there.
This is a fun question. It's something I think about when people tell me they're going to go visit Bakersfield. They ask about food.
Oh, yeah.
It comes up a lot. And you could mention the Basque places. I have mixed feelings. I've had mixed experiences.
Yeah.
But what I always tell them is breakfast is king in Bakersfield.
Yes, it
And I think that's probably comes from the oil field culture of being up really early in the morning and needing like a breakfast to get through the day. If you were taking someone to visit Bakersfield, where would you take them for breakfast?
I would take them to my granny's house if she were still alive, because one of the things I always admired was in that on the again on my dad's side of things, she had 10 kids, and those kids picked cotton before school and after school. She made lunch every day and made a pie every day for lunch. Made pie for lunch every day. So we were raised on that. We've had a lot of okra and things like that. We didn't really go to restaurants a lot. But I will say, I want to back it up just a little bit and say, you mentioned Basque. So I'll tell you that my wedding rehearsal dinner was at Chateau Basque. And that was delicious. All of our guests were surprised to be served tongue, so that was exciting. And then, but I didn't fully answer your question about the Crystal Palace,
Oh,
because
yeah.
when my dad recently died, both my when my mother passed a couple years ago, her funeral memorial, not the service itself, but the lunch was at Crystal Palace. And then when my dad died, we had a big memorial service, and Buck Owens' backup band from Crystal Palace sang at his funeral celebration. They sing, "I'll fly away," and "Will the circle be unbroken?" And everybody was crying. Just want
Oh
you
yeah.
to know
Oh yeah.
that.
Oh yeah, absolutely. One more Bakersfield question before we transition to historical fiction. I often hear people say that Bakersfield is an outlier in California. It's the other California. And I think what's the subtext there is that there's something orthogonal about Bakersfield that doesn't relate to the broader history of California, that it's its own separate thing that's not connected. Do you agree with that, or do you think Bakersfield is actually somewhat central, you might say, in California history, but in a way people don't often think about?
I do think it's true that people don't think about Bakersfield, and when they do, it's in an insulting kind of way. But and is it part of it? Is it different? I believe it is different. Do you read much of Richard Rodriguez?
Oh, yeah.
Hunger of Memory, I'm thinking of Round Boy, and I can't remember in which of those. I went to see him speak one time, and he was talking about memory. About where you've been and where you're going. And it's interesting to me that because my family picked cotton and potatoes and lived in a tent, lived in at the Sunset labor camp in Arvin area, I think it is, that really touched me and marked me. And it affected what would turn into be my worldview and maybe my politics. And it has, because I felt just emotionally hurt by stories of my own family members being treated so dreadfully by the communities that surrounded the highway that they would be parking along. And that extended to what I feel about the world in general. And it has been, as Richard Rodriguez said in that speech I heard him give, that it's surprising to him that the children of the Joads now drive around Bakersfield in really expensive SUVs with their windows up, judging the people by the side of the road. And that's my complicated feeling about being a Californian, is that I chose to go to college in LA. I chose to live as an adult in Northern California. I didn't choose to stay in Bakersfield. And I'm still defensive about Bakersfield. I want to protect it. But I also think, come on now. If all of our grannies slept outside of the car next to the ditch, who are we to be critiquing the people who are doing that right now? So I think part of it is that what distinguishes Bakersfield maybe from other regions is that I think a lot of the people whose family immigrated there were humiliated. They were treated so badly that humiliation got in them. And they definitely did not want to be associated with that, many of them, not all of them. And they also had very little patience for people who did not seem to have climbed out of it as their family did. So I think there's part of the difference between the Central Valley and Northern and Southern California is that people are walking around with some partly unhealed bruises that are affecting their attitudes today.
I have that defensiveness in it in me too, and it's funny when it comes out, it's almost like a reflex almost now. Because I live in Fresno now, and often these cities are compared, and Fresno enjoys putting down Bakersfield, I feel like. And so it feels like siblings bickering is more than
I
anything.
felt like when I moved from Bakersfield to Los Angeles for college, of course, there was that. And then when I moved from Los Angeles to San Francisco, San Francisco definitely made fun of Bakersfield. Then I moved from San Francisco to Sacramento. And San Francisco makes fun of Sacramento, and Sacramento makes fun of Bakersfield. So it's a lot of really weird things.
Yes, totally absurd snobbery.
It is bizarre snobbery. Bizarre
Yeah.
snobbery.
Let's talk about historical fiction. I'm curious to start. This is a history podcast. I'm curious if you think that historical fiction and traditional history writing are part of the same project, or do you think they're on separate but parallel tracks, you might say?
That is great. Clearly, straight historical nonfiction is the great source material for historical fiction. But even if what I'm most familiar with, like talking to people who do this work, are people who write historical fiction. And in that world, when I go around to historical fiction conferences, one of the things I learn is that there is definitely a continuum in this world about how tightly historical fiction needs to hug the source material. So that I have very good friends whose books I love, who are right here on that continuum, who, as an example, they write biographical historical fiction, and their novels will adhere really strictly to the memoirs or original documents of those people who lived. I'm really more in the middle. If you look at the other end of the continuum, it's people who like maybe do whole alt history fiction, and they redo everything. Maybe Lincoln wasn't killed, things like that. He was impeached instead. I'm in the middle, which means the way I explain that to you is my relation to historical nonfiction is that I always get inspired by historical nonfiction. If I can find something that's really sticky, which for me means it captures my interest, and very often it's because it resonates today. It doesn't feel old and dusty. It feels like this was happening then, and I'm feeling that about today. So I like to find those things in nonfiction. And the very best thing for me is when there's a hole, where there's a cave in that record, because then, because I write fiction, I can go into that cave and invent a character who did not exist, but I want the fictional incidents and events to be firmly rooted in the historical record. But because I write fiction, I have the freedom to create individuals in that setting to demonstrate something that I'm interested in. So, do I rely on historical nonfiction? Absolutely. And it's much harder work than I can do because I think that I would be impatient as a straight historical nonfiction writer because of the exactitude, the accuracy that's so necessary, and how long you could go on researching any given thing to get it recorded right, and still know that even after you've done all that objective and conscientious work, you could be wrong. You could be affected by your own worldview, as we all are. I really respect the work of historians and I rely on their work. I could not do it. I am not that. And I found my place on the continuum that allows me to be who I am.
I read this interesting interview with Neil Ferguson. He's a historian, a British historian, and he was talking about historical fiction. He made a slightly denigrating comment I would be curious your perspective on. He
Sure.
said that reading historical fiction for him feels like playing tennis without a net, where there are no rules, quote unquote. And I'm curious for you to react to that because
Sure.
I think there is an element of, at least for me, in thinking about genre, I read novels that are labeled literary fiction but have a strong historical basis. And it feels like what really is historical fiction in relative to fiction that relies on some history? You know what I'm saying? I guess what I'm asking you is to help me both respond to what Neil's saying and
Sure.
then also unpack where the boundaries are.
And oh my gosh, you're just the boundaries are always moving. It's a very frustrating thing. I've got a few responses to that. One is that Neil has a worldview and an expectation that what he reads will provide X, Y, and Z experience, and it will be shaped by the following rules. And other people read it with other expectations. It may be adjacent. If it's a great big pie, his expectations might be here, and readers of historical fiction may have their expectations aligned with it, but further to the right. I'll say for me and a lot of my readers and readers of historical fiction who like it that way, it's because it's not without a net, it's a different net. And
Okay.
it's not without rules. It's different rules. So, for instance, most readers, avid readers of fiction, are looking for a certain shape of things. They're looking for an arc, some kind of arc. And there are many different versions to do that, ways of doing that. And they're looking for character change over time as a result of interaction with events. And Actually, nonfiction has not helped to account for that desire we have for this ancient shape and architecture of story. Very often it just happens, but historical writing doesn't have to have anybody change. It can be like almost an odyssey shape where here's the first thing that happened, then this happened, and then this happened, and then this happened, and this happened, and then he died. Right? And that can be very accurate and useful and meaningful to the people who are looking for those details. For someone whose first instinct is to hew to the shape of fiction, it's not as satisfying. It's just almost repetitive and shapeless if it's not developing a character in their relation to other characters. My husband is an example of this, where he loves to study both World War II and the Civil War. And he reads every book on these topics, and he listens to all the audiobooks and podcasts and everything. And whenever we take driving trips, he usually dominates the dial on the machinery. And one of the things that just does get me, it because I'm not a historian, I'm not as interested in a very long list of names of ships and how much it cost to build the ships and how many men served on the ships and so forth. I want to know what happened down below. You
Yeah.
know what I
Yeah,
mean?
you're looking for story, not plot there, maybe.
That's right. That's right.
To add my own editorial to this, what I think is interesting about that statement is I think it underplays the kind of creative activity that goes on when you're writing history. So it's not like it's some kind of conduit where you just have to go to the sources and then you get an exact like photograph or picture of exactly how it was. Every historian is taking a bunch of things and then creating a narrative out of it.
They
And so in
are.
my mind, it resembles historical fiction quite a bit. You're just maybe it's the purposes of it are different, maybe slightly, and one is has much more of an entertainment element. But then you could also argue that a lot of history is written. The great histories that I've read are creative. They're expressive of what a period feels like. And so it
Narrative
feels.
nonfiction, like an emphasis on that narrative as
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, I'm glad we figured out that he's wrong there.
well.
All right. Who are your models for historical fiction? Who do you look to?
Oh my gosh. I read so many of them. Who are my models?
Yeah, who are
Well,
your leading lights, if you will?
okay. This doesn't work to answer your question, but I'm going to use it anyway because it's the first thing that jumped into my mind. And that is actually a book I could recommend to you today. Joan Didion's Where I Was From jumped into the forefront of my mind because she was writing nonfiction in the form of really essays about this place where she was from, and in that case was Sacramento, where I live now. And it moved me a lot because she included things like the connection between this region and the Donner Party, and how so she would tell about what happened with the Donner Party, the parts that she was interested in, and then connect it to the people who were living in Sacramento in the 1950s, and how did that affect their view of California and Californians as being somehow opportunistic, maybe ambitious, gritty, resilient, do what you need to do. That is a way of writing that I'm not saying I'm writing like her at all, not at all. I'm not writing nonfiction. But there's something that's always been very meaningful to me in reading the way she blends facts. And let's be honest, she's handpicking the facts she finds interesting, which is a way of telling a story. She's not telling all the facts. She's handpicking the facts she finds interesting and lingering over them to make meaning out of them. I'm not writing essays, the essay format, but I'm definitely reading history to find what I consider those sticky points that have resonance for me now and personally. And I'm hand selecting those elements of history in order to hold them up and examine them in this fictional way, in a way that gratifies me. So that's one person. And I don't think she fits our description our definition here, but honestly, the very first book that jumped into my mind.
Yeah, I read a lot of literary fiction and poetry. That's how I operate. So I don't think it really matters personally. For you, what's the stopping point when you're in the research process, really trying to understand a historical period? I talk with novelists sometimes about their kind of reading habits while they're writing a novel. And there are certain people that they don't read because they don't want that to be in their head and they want to have that creative space to make. But you're in this kind of weird, kind of nebulous place of you want to know as much as you can, but you also want to leave yourself opportunity for creation. So how does that look for you?
Let me tell you how it worked in this last book, The An Unlikely Prospect, is that when I finished my previous book, Poster Girl, I was casting about for a new topic, for a new area to explore. And I found a book called, by Charles Farakia. It was a history of San Francisco from 1945 to present when he wrote it. He was the founder of the San Francisco Historical Society and San Francisco History Museum. And the very first chapter told a little bit about how in 1945, about how the United Nations had their conference there in preparation of forming. And then the very next paragraph was, oh, and there was this peace riot, which is the subject matter of my book. So I don't need to go in that now. But what happened was that I was shocked how little he said about it when it sounded like a really big deal. And so then I started doing the research, going to newspapers.com, trying to find out what exactly had happened, and then going to really, when I was struggling so much to find evidence of what had happened in his claims in that history book, I reached out to so many librarians, and I maybe more than I needed to, but it totally validated what I would later do. I consulted first with just because he was a friend, the chief archivist in the library system in Sacramento, but the San Francisco Historical Society, the San Francisco Public Library, the California Law Library, UC Berkeley's library, all these, the clerk of the court in San Francisco, trying to find the evidence, the historical record of what was missing that I needed for my novel. And all of these librarians are, oh my gosh, it's not there. We cannot find it. They're all saying it's not there. And that led me to a dejected feeling until I remembered I'm a novelist. And so the fact that there's this little space that's open and not defined and not totally created, it just made me say, calm down. This is where you get to invent, like I said before. And so at that point, then I started writing because I know the facts, like a lot of the things that are, a lot of the plot points that are in my novel are taken from newspaper articles. There, I know what happened to whom and on what block it happened and all that kind of stuff. But where I don't know, then I've got to invent, but still the research goes on. I'm sure you've heard that from other novelists that like you're, oh, dumb things. It would sound dumb to anybody, not dumb to me. It's not on my desk right now. I have Emily Post's Etiquette from 1934 behind me on the shelf. I can't tell you when I make a dinner party in 1945, I'm like, how exactly would that have been served? And what would the forks and knives have been doing at this dressy table where the governor was going to be there? So it's always tempting to return to the source material to make sure you get it right. And it's tempting not just out of fear of getting things wrong, but because there's great pleasure in finding those details right out. Although it can prevent you from actually doing the darn writing because
Yep.
you can research forever.
Yeah, let me jump in and push you on something that I've heard quite a bit. Oftentimes, I hear that people think the challenge of writing historical fiction is getting the physical space accurate. But I think probably the harder part is recreating the mental space of characters. How do you think about that task of trying to? Because we project so much onto historical characters. You watch any of those wonderful TV shows, those dramas with the kings and queens, Mary, Queen of Scots, and they're having very modern conversations. They're not thinking about the chain of being and, different in feudal roles. They're having romantic romantic conversations like that I overhear teenagers having. How do you think about recreating the mind of a character?
I'll start backing it up just a tiny bit. When you talk about recreating place, when it might look different and be different than it is now, I will say that I was lucky enough to land on a book long before I was writing that I loved reading all the time anyway, that it was like the WPA paid writers during the Depression to write like compendia about a city or a region. So there's the WPA Guide to San Francisco in the 30s and 40s. And that book had every restaurant, every bar, every bank. How much did it cost to ride cross town in a jitney? Where was it possible to get a cab? Everything was in that. So in terms of creating place, you can go to San Francisco, as I do all the time, and experience the weather and the fog and the smells and things like that. But when you go to the source material, you're reminded that Folgers used to have their plant right here. So everybody in this neighborhood smelled coffee all the time. You find that in the source material, and it matters to people. It really does. And yet, about the characters, that is, you put your finger on something that's so huge among all the historical fiction writers I know. We call it the question of presentism. I don't know if someone else has talked to you about that.
Yeah.
But it's exactly what you're saying, that the question of how, to what degree do you try to recreate as accurately as possible and maybe authentically as possible the way people spoke and thought and acted in that time period? And to what degree do you allow yourself to modify that for either the needs of your audience or for your own evil, dastardly purposes as a writer with their own consciousness? And for me, when I turned in the first draft of my first novel, Copy Boy, I had leaned so hard into the Dust Bowl accents of my grannies that it was dense with their accents, dense with it. And I got the first notes back from the editor, and she's, "You understand, 80% of this has to go. It might be the way they spoke, but nobody can read this. They're going to stop reading it because that dialect is just too dense, however, quote unquote, accurate you think it is." And so at that point, I first started learning about a strategy where you say, I'm going to save some very accurate and off time authentic language in significant moments, maybe emotional moments or dangerous moments or things like that, when the character rises up and the reader is reminded about that time and place. So it's important to get it in there, but you don't want to weigh it down because the pleasure of reading is gone for a lot of your audience. So
Yeah, I enjoy Hurston's book, Their Eyes Are Watching God.
oh yeah.
But when you're reading through the di it's work. You have to have that patience. And I'm sure if you're a publisher, you're thinking like, we want people to be able to breeze through this, if you will.
And I think it's more true now than before. People had a lot more patience with reading before than they do now, which is why books are getting thinner, to
Yeah.
make them not feel overwhelmed even to pick it up. But I want to see, there's another part of that I'd be really eager to know your opinion about that we talk about a lot, which is the use of language that would be accurate and authentic. If I'm writing a Dust Bowl Okie character as my first protagonist was, there are things she would say that I do not feel comfortable saying because it's what everyone around her would have said. The language that are pejorative terms. And so you have to comb through and make your decision about what is appropriate. So even in my current book, there's a scene where there is a rape, and I am not someone who can really flesh out a rape. I can't describe it, meaning I just don't, it's not me. It's not in my consciousness. I don't feel I almost have the right to do that, and I just can't do it. So at the end of the chapter, where the brief chapter where a rape occurs, through my whole drafting process, I had as the last word in that chapter something that the rapist said to the victim, the survivor. He used the C word, and it was the last word in that chapter in a novel that really doesn't have much swearing in it at all. And I felt like that C word was the rape for me. it was the violence encapsulated in one word to me. And I got done drafting. I was trying to send it off. And Jordan, I deleted it. I changed that chapter. And I have thoughts about it. I have regrets about making that change. I think that accurately and authentically belonged. It showed the power and the hostility and the violence of what happened in that scene that I didn't otherwise show. And I think it's something he would have said. And yet, because the consciousness of the book is Shelley Blanton Stroud, I could not leave it in there. And I think the chapter is not as good as it was originally because I had to make that choice. And in fact, when I talked about this at a conference one time, people in the audience said, "You weren't wrong. You weren't wrong. That was the right decision." Then afterward, a young woman came up to me and she goes, "I don't even know what you're talking about. We use that word all the time. That's not even a thing. That doesn't bother anybody. I don't know what you're so offended by." So I think that these choices about accuracy and authenticity, when you're talking about the past or describing the past, they get troubling for someone who's living in the present. It's hard to be a person in the present and do it all accurately. And is that the goal, to be accurate 100%?
Yeah, I think such a difficult topic because obviously there's a political dimension to this. There's the world of publishing that plays into this. There's an epistemological question, which is how can we really know what we know anyway?
That's
And
right.
we're constantly producing things. And I think you were dealing with that kind of epistemological question mixed in with that political question about what is appropriate for me to say. And I don't know. I don't really have, I don't think I have a, I don't have distinct thoughts about it other than to say, I think we are constantly creating stuff, and who's to say what is an accurate experience? And it seems like a complicated thing. I want to jump actually into your book now, though. I have a couple questions. I want to start by just describing historically what the Peace Riots were. I actually didn't know about them until I read your book. Obviously, these are not, it doesn't feel like they're well covered in the historical literature and historiography of the history of the end of World War II in San Francisco. I'm not familiar seeing it in any text I've read. Can you describe generally what happened and why there was no answer and why there was no one that was adjudicated?
Sure. So on VJ Day, when Japan had unconditionally surrendered in World War II, everybody knows about the celebrations that broke out in streets across the United States. You've all seen the photographs, the Life magazine, and
Sailors kissing people.
Exactly. We're familiar with all that. Apparently, or perhaps, San Francisco was the only city whose celebration turned into a riot. And it went on for 3 days. And part of the reason, let me say that in that rioting, 1,000 people were hospitalized, 11 to 13 were killed. There's some back and forth on that number. And at least 6 women were raped. And that means 6 women went to a hospital where they wrote down that they had those patients, though they didn't get their names. We don't know if they went to any other hospitals or just went home. This violence happened. And so, what happened then? You have to understand that San Francisco was this disembarkation point for sailors who would be going off on ships to the Pacific Theater. So, if you imagine in August of 1945, maybe 100,000 sailors, maybe 18 and 19 years old, are collected in this city. And they're about to be shipped off to fight in this war that they did not want to go. They're human beings, right? And when Japan's surrender was announced, this huge collection of very young men began to celebrate to no one's surprise. Everyone celebrated everywhere. They had very good reason to celebrate. But a lot of things combined there. One of them was that the merchants up and down Market Street, which is where the celebration mainly happened, a number of them, maybe they sold sofas in their business, but they found a way to buy alcohol and sell it to the sailors on the street and everybody on the street for low prices. So you have thousands of joyous people on the street, young men, many of them, drinking more than they should, more than is reasonable. And The police department was very understaffed because so many men were at war that the police ranks were diminished, so that the police department pulled in an auxiliary force of just citizens who were trained to be the police force. They were not prepared for an event of this nature. They did not know how to do it. They were not really police officers. And then the one that kind of bothers me among the most is that the military, it would have made sense to say at the end of day one to all those sailors, back to the ship, back to your bunk, everybody back to your bunk. You don't have to go to war, but your service isn't over yet. Get back to your bunk. But they didn't do that. And some of them went back, but many stayed and continued, and it turned into this sort of wilding. And then laid on top of that, the reason you don't know about it, those are some of the reasons why it happened. But the reason you don't really know about it is that almost immediately, the DA at the time, who was our former governor of California, Pat Brown, convened a grand jury. And 2 weeks later, they arrived at their conclusion, which was that nobody's guilty of anything. Everybody did the best they can, and we want to commend everybody. And so there was no pursuit of what happened. There was no investigation, nothing at all. And I speculate as to why the DA did this and why everyone in San Francisco in a position of authority felt the need to tamp down investigation and reporting on it. But the result of it is that there's almost nothing in the newspapers. There's some in the newspapers, but very little in the newspapers. And they certainly weren't following up afterward because there was no investigation going on. It was like, yay, war's over. Let's get to our new economy. So that's the reason it's not in the history books. And that's why Charles Frakia, in his San Francisco Historical Society text on San Francisco, had two paragraphs on this really significant thing. And I really haven't found it in other textbooks.
I'd be curious to see if this is covered in David Nasaw's new book that's just coming out. It's called The Wounded Generation Coming Home After World War II. I
Oh
would
my
be
God.
curious if he covers it. I pre-ordered the book. I don't know if it's out yet. Is it out yet? Sorry. No, it's not out till October. But yeah, it's an interesting kind of moment in history and a moment that I think in different parts of the world is covered more. There's this great book called Bloodlands that talks about the after World War II in Europe and like the friction and all the violence that happened with soldiers just operating in Poland, Soviet soldiers coming through and the long history of rapes and stuff. But I don't know. I'm not familiar with that in Americanist literature, historiography. It's interesting. Let's jump to Sandy though. Sandy Zimmer, your protagonist, plucky protagonist. I don't think it's giving anything away to say that her husband dies pretty early on in the novel, and she has to assume a different position. I feel like there's this long line of journalist heroes from Scoop, Evelyn Waugh, to The Quiet American, your Graham Greene, to It Can't Happen Here, to movies, All the President's Men, one of my favorites, Spotlight, about the group that investigated the Catholic Church. How did you think about situating Sandy within this big universe of journalist heroes?
Great question, because my first three books were a trilogy featuring someone who was a gossip columnist who wanted to be a reporter, really. So it was from the point of view of someone who wants to investigate, be on the ground. And that was really fun for me. But what I began to be interested in, because of things that are happening in the journalism world today, where we're beginning to feel how journalism itself is feeling, it's always felt pressure. It's always been true that there's always been the question of ad dollars. That's always been a pressure. But I was very interested in the business side of journalism. So I thought about, and I had been railing in my head against authority figures who might have made something of this event and been truthful and brought about justice and didn't. And so that allowed me, in a fictional way, to want to do a what if there was a figure who would take care of this in the, or at least try. She doesn't take care of this. She tries to do the right thing. And it was interesting to me not to make her a reporter, in fact, to make her a publisher and an owner, so that she's simultaneously worried about the success of the newspaper itself, the enterprise itself. She does not want advertisers to flood away from their paper. She does not want government sources to dry up for her reporters. She wants to keep paying the paychecks of the people who work there. And I think that plays a very big role in the way stories are being told. Even today, even this very morning, there's news regarding reporters being silenced when their owners or publishers disagree with what they're reporting. So that was very important to me. It not just to come at it from that angle, but also to be willing to say, Sandy does not get everything right. She does not get everything right. And she sometimes cuts corners that she should not cut, ideally, or if you're a perfectionist. But I was more interested in that telling or exploration of when you're basically trying to do the right thing in a journalism world. But you feel the pressures, and those pressures are real from your board and from government and from bankers and all of that. What do you do?
Yeah. I'm going to pause this real quick. I need to go grab my computer charger. I'm sorry. I forgot to grab it from my office,
Ah, no
and my
problem.
computer's on death's door. So just give me one.
Okay.
When that Apple charging sound hits and you just feel like that sweet relief that you're not going to die, it's so nice. Obviously, we're talking about publishers, we're talking about a woman. I'm sure Katharine Graham just comes up constantly for you. How important was she in developing the character? How big of a role did she play in your mind?
She was very important. I did some research into women who were publishers at that actual time, and I didn't find someone who was a model for my protagonist. I did find Cissy Patterson, who's a character in the book, a real life publisher in that day, and she was fascinating, fantastic memoir, but she was not a model for my main character. She was ruthless. She says, when they rape your grandma, put her on the front page. She was that kind of person. There was also, in my town where I'm living, Sacramento, Eleanor McClatchy was part of the McClatchy family, and then she inherited into leadership of the McClatchy newspapers, not just the Bee. But a lot of the times when I talk to people who worked on the Bee, they would say she did what was typical when a woman came in. She surrounded herself with the men who could do it right, and she could be their figurehead. And please, this is something I will get mean letters about. I'm not saying that's Eleanor McClatchy. I'm just saying that I had heard a little bit about that. So I was very inspired by Katharine Graham, by her memoir, A Personal, Personal History. Oh my gosh, it
Yeah,
jumps right out of my head.
personal history. You got it.
Yeah. And part of it was, even though she lived 2 decades after the events, or she was working 2 decades after this, there were so many similarities between my pre-existing character of Sandy. She was in the earlier novels, two of the earlier novels. So I knew I was going to use her. And her personality was enough like Sandy that I thought, okay, this could be interesting. But what I really took from Katharine Graham was that she never pictured herself. She never featured herself as someone who could do this, who could be this leader in such an organization at very high stakes situations. And yet it came on her. The crown came to her and she decided to take action. And it was not easy. And it took a while for her to accept it fully and to become herself in that role. And that's the part that was really defining for me with Sandy Zimmer, including the fact that there's an absolutely terrific photograph of Katharine Graham in a book called The Only Woman in the Room. And it shows her boardroom with all these men in dark suits and Katharine Graham in a neon blue pretty suit. And the only woman in the room because of Katharine Graham is something that I totally zeroed in on and was inspired by.
One second, Shelley.
Sure.
Hey, Shelley, give me 2 minutes. I need to move,
Sure.
reserve the conference room, but there's another meeting right at three.
Okay.
And
All
so
right.
arrive. So just give me about 2 minutes.
Sure.
I feel like there's always chaos on Mondays. I don't know what it is.
Makes sense.
I run a library. I've got an archive in here that I manage. And then there's all these conference rooms with people coming in and out. It can be a little hectic.
You get it.
Okay, let's two more questions before we wrap up. I want to ask you how conducting the research for this book changed your perspective on California history. Did it alter your story that you tell yourself? Did it clarify some things that maybe were vague? What effect did it have on your understanding of what California is?
About larger than California, the fact that when I went hunting for the grand jury report that would explain why the grand jury found no fault, and there was no grand jury report, though there was one from 1937, 38, 39, 40, 41, 42, 43, 44, 46, 47, not 1945. It first of all reminded me that even with the most conscientious historians, we don't have access to what we don't have access to. That's one part of it. And another is that there might be bad actors. And it connected me to today when things are being disappeared. History is being disappeared. Records are being disappeared. Even digital records of things are being disappeared. So that was one of the big effects for me in doing this research. But about California history itself, It got me thinking about periods in California history that I think might be connected even thematically to this novel. One thing is, you can't really talk about California without talking about the gold rush. And as a historical person yourself, you must be tired of the gold rush thinking, but really, it defines a lot of the mythology of this place. And I'm not sure it's false. This is a state full of people who are ambitious. They want to win the contest. They want to come out on top of that pyramid. And it was true then, fighting for each little nugget of gold. And it was certainly true of San Francisco. San Francisco was directly affected by the gold rush. And I have my character, Sandy's father-in-law, who's the grandson of gold rush bankers.
I agree with you, Shelley. I honestly think today, and you're right to bring up the gold rush because I think it is the prism. And I think today we have 49ers, if you will, but instead of mining for gold, they're mining for attention, whether that's through entertainment or technology or cryptocurrency for that matter. It is extraction. The culture of extraction is so central to California. And I think you're right to point at that. And that's how I think about it as well.
And that can explain a lot of the events that happen in California. It's even the problems that we find it difficult to solve are because there are so many people fighting on that hill, trying to get that thing they want for their purpose, that they knock down everybody else. So it makes it very difficult for us to solve anything. Everybody's trying to solve for that thing they want to extract. And maybe that's just America. Maybe it's just America.
Yeah,
But
maybe this is just a broader discussion about America.
But I
Absolutely.
do think it's connected to the gold rush for sure.
Absolutely. Absolutely. We close these podcasts in the same place, which is with book recommendations. What are a few books you'd like to recommend to listeners?
Okay, so earlier I mentioned the Joan Didion, where I was from. That means
Oh,
a
it's such a great book. If you're from
lot.
California, it's such a fantastic read. Absolutely. And does it make you super sentimental about Sacramento?
It does. There are parts in it, there are little moments in it. The American River and the trail alongside of it is like 1 mile from my house. And when Joan Didion from all those decades ago describes walking along the river and how you can see the heat waves rising from the dirt and how there's a rattlesnake slithering across the path, things like that, it oddly makes me feel sentimental about a place I'm still living in. It's like it's gone, but it's not gone. So that's part of it. And also, there's a ruthless way she talks about this place that it's honest and it's accurate and it's 100% shaped by her own worldview and her own angle on things. So lots of other people can see it differently. So that's one that I highly recommend. Another one that's more current is, oh gosh, wrote down the title because I'm so good at, so not good. So bad at remembering the details. Let's see. Oh, right. Shoot.
Take your
Oh,
time,
it
Shelley.
can't be. Okay. It's Gary Camilla's Cool Gray City of Love. It's
Yes.
a beautifully written book. All of his are. He was a reporter and a columnist for the San Francisco Chronicle. And he actually is the one who wrote a lot of the articles that I based my current novel on. Because 10 years ago, on the 70th anniversary of VJ Day, he started reporting on what had happened in San Francisco and finding that information. And that led me to Gary Camilla. And this Cool Gray City of Love is a series of essays about particular places in this city. And you mentioned setting before. If you feel like hearing a beautiful description of very different neighborhoods by an author at the top of his game, who loves that place, I do recommend Gary Camilla.
I love him. I've been trying to get him on the podcast forever. His stuff is fantastic. And if you haven't read him before, he's just the pictures he paints of a place are unparalleled. And San Francisco is a place with a lot of pockets and a lot of like very micro neighborhoods where there's very distinct stories to tell. And I think he does it about as well as any stylist I know. Absolutely. To close, Shelley, what are you working on next?
Right now, I'm not writing yet, but I'm researching. And the focus of my research is actually Earl Warren.
Oh.
was raised and went to high school in Bakersfield, our hometown, and obviously spent a lot of time in Sacramento as our governor. And I've always been interested in Bakersfield. I don't think he gets a lot of props because there's resentment for his Supreme Court activities. And in Sacramento, I don't think he's gets a lot of props because there's resentment of the role he played in Japanese internment. So that's always been interesting to me. But the sticky thing that really pulled me in that I'm starting to investigate is that his father was murdered in Bakersfield and in 1938 when he was DA in Alameda County and just about to run for governor, preparing himself. He was on the rise. And the Bakersfield chief of police offered to put listening devices in a San Quentin cell and to place a snitch in the cell in order to get information from someone they thought might have information. And supposedly, Earl Warren said, "Don't do for me what I wouldn't let you do for somebody else." And his father's murder was never solved. And when I talked earlier about a fiction writer's desire to find something sticky, to me, that is sticky.
That feels like noir out of the 1950s. Absolutely. It feels like you can really run with that. Shelley, this has been so much fun chatting with you. Again, the book is called An Unlikely Prospect. I loved it so much. I really enjoyed the read. It, I think what you want from historical fiction is to transport you and grip you, and I think it does both of those things very well. So I really appreciate the writing and really loved reading it.
Thank you, and I've got some bad news. The next time I get deep in the weeds, I will be emailing you to ask for your help with some research.
That's fine. Thanks for listening, everyone. If you enjoyed this podcast, please consider supporting us by either giving us a rating and review or by making a financial contribution at our Patreon page, which is www.patreon.com/historyofcalifornia. We'll see you next time.